Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. On our way to break, I'm going to let you know that Paul Beller tweeted in that conversation, and then you realize why you moved. Even just one little step, exclamation point, many times. Thank you, Paul, for that tweet. He tweeted at Mark Steiner, by the way, and you can join us here at 410-319-8888 by phone or email us at talkatsteinershow.org. On our way to talking to Bill Ayers about his book, I want to remind you the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. Remember, it's not just a bank, it's a credit union. It belongs to you. Money comes back in the end. More information at www.mecu.com or at steinershow.org is their banner. Now we're here with Bill Ayers, 410-319-8888. And he's written a new book, Demand the Impossible, a Radical Manifesto. And it is a manifesto. It is a manifesto. I remember when we saw each other last, you were talking about this book was going to be coming out. And I love just a quick digression. It's really not a digression because it's in the book. I love the way you begin the book before we get into the whole notion of what if, because you went to Greece.
Right.
To speak to a bunch of anarchists. And you actually met somebody who many of you might not know, but I know who he was. I read him and went, oh, man, that was cool. You met Manolos Glessos.
That's correct. I begin the book with that because I had an extraordinary day with Manolos about 5 years ago now. I'd gone to Greece to speak in an anarchist
convention. Still with us.
He is still with us. In fact, I read about him every few months in the New York Times because he gets arrested.
94 years old, still getting arrested.
Still getting arrested at the Greek Parliament. But I was in Greece at this anarchist convention, as you said, and I remember saying to them when they picked me up, are you sure you're anarchist? Because you're having a convention. But we had a lot of fun and spent a few days in Athens. And then through mutual friends, I took a fast boat out to a small island 5 hours from Athens, and I met with this legendary figure. Manolos is well known in Europe and a folk hero in Greece because he was arrested at the age of 14 for taking the Nazi flag off the Acropolis during the German occupation of Greece during World War II. His brother was killed. He was hunted. He was given the death penalty. He did many years in prison under the Germans and then later under the generals. But he kept his vision. He kept his utopian spirit. He kept his hopes alive, and he still is. But our day together, the reason I start the book with that story is because as we talked politics, we talked life, we talked art, but as we were going back to the dock to get so that I could take a boat back to Athens, he said something very profound to me. He said, I think the problem we have in Greece, and I believe it's your problem in the United States as well, is the problem that we don't have enough confidence in ourselves. We don't believe that we could change the world and run our own affairs. And if we believed it deeply enough, we could do it. But that's my determination, he said. I'm determined to create a spirit of confidence where we don't need the generals, we don't need the chiefs of police, we don't need mayors. We can run our own affairs, and we need the hope and the confidence to do it.
And one of the things you kind of your philosophical statement sort of that you begin this book and goes all through it is the question you ask, what if?
Right.
Right?
Right. Utopian question, what if? And the that originally the working title of this book was What If, and then
that's kind of a cool title though. What if? I like that.
I liked it too.
they didn't like it.
Well, in my conversation with the publishers there's this wonderful phrase that's was a piece of graffiti from the French uprising in 1968. It's sometimes attributed to Che Guevara, but it says, be realistic, demand the impossible. And I like the contradiction there. But what if is the question that powers the book? And the point of it is that we all are enmeshed, entangled in the world as it is. But standing next to the world as it is a possible world and maybe a world that ought to be. And if we can't awaken that in our imaginations, then we strangle ourselves. So the point is to say, look, it's this way, but what if it were a different way? And why are we caught in the thrall of debates that are not in terms that we want to talk about the issues in? So, for example, I mean, there are many examples in the book, but for example, why is the debate between Obamacare or just handing over health to, the insurance industries? Why is that the debate? Why aren't we debating free universal health care for everyone? And many other issues. Why are we debating, reform of the prison system when we could be debating whether prisons should exist at all, whether that institution of congealed violence should exist at all? Now, it gets dreamy. It gets utopian. But utopian is part of what we have to be.
So I want to come back to some of the specifics in these chapters. That, and you mentioned a couple of them I really did want to hit on, especially the prison abolition piece that you wrote about and the complexities of that. We wrestled with that on this show before. But when we look at where we are and that what you said a moment ago about be realistic, but
demand the impossible.
Demand the impossible. Let's talk about what that means. I mean, because when you look at what we face today, when we look at, I said to somebody the other day, I said, you know, that there's, people have these changing definitions over the years of the word revolution. What does revolution mean? And one person said even to me, revolution, it's a constant. It keeps moving. Revolution, it keeps rolling. That's what it means. Look it up. That's what it means.
I like that. Yeah.
Right? So, and I started thinking about that because when you have to be realistic in the face of what you face out here, when you have to face the reality of the power, let's say, in Baltimore City, of the Fraternal Order of Police, of the way we police the city, the battle that just took place here, you may not be aware of, over a thing called Port Covington, which was this development by Under Armour.
Yes.
Where people were trying to say there's a different way of developing our city that takes care of all the people, not just the wealthy few. But then realism, your spirit of what if butts up against the realistic wall of where the power is.
That's correct. And that's part of it. And the reason is, if you think about it, the common phrase that we've heard all through this election season is politics is the art of the possible. It just reeks of opportunism. It reeks of accepting the status quo as necessary. And we make little tweaks here and there. That's why I think we have to say, yes, we have to make a concrete analysis of real conditions. We have to think strategically and tactically about where we are. But if we don't know where we want to go, we'll never get there. If all we do is focus on the complaints and the oppressions and the injustices, we don't know where we're going. Bernadine and I hosted Albie Sachs, who was a great South African freedom fighter many years ago, in conversation with the great Palestinian scholar Rashid Khalidi in our living room. And one of the things they talked about at great length was that during the fight against apartheid, the ANC would take days and weeks off and talk about what kind of society they were trying to build. And many of the cadre would say, why are we doing this? We have to smash apartheid. And the answer was, we need to do it or we will make tactical and strategic mistakes along the way. If we don't know what we're fighting for, we won't either have the spirit or the energy or the wisdom to get there. And so sometimes we need to posit what we want. Many of us are quite skilled at saying at a critique of what is. But the problem is, then what? What do you want? And that's part of what I'm trying to do. You talk about revolution is constantly moving. I remember a wonderful comment by Eduardo Galeano, the great Uruguayan revolutionary. And Galeano was criticized for being a utopian. And he says, well, there's truth to the criticism, because every time I take two steps towards utopia, it moves two steps away. I walk 10 steps towards utopia, and utopia moves farther toward the horizon. He says, so what the hell good is utopia? And he says, that's what it's good for. It's good for walking. And the brilliance of that to me is that something has to keep us going. Look, you've been at this a long time. Why are you still at it when many of the people who were comrades of yours have grown old and tired? not that we're not old, but somehow we're not tired. We're not tired yet, as long as we get breath. But the point is, something has to keep us going, and that something is in part asking the question, what if? This is the way it is, but what if it were otherwise?
Let me take some of the parts of the book here. There's and you mentioned prison abolition, and it was a really fascinating chapter to me that you put in. You have lots of chapters in here. Abolition, Shoulders of the Wheel, Jubilee, we'll get to a bunch of these. The abolition piece was interesting. When I read this piece, I thought about the Crow Dog story. Let me just throw this out, and then you talk about what abolition means to you. Leonard Crow Dog, who is a Native American spiritual leader, he's still with us, who was kind of the spiritual leader of the American Indian movement back in the 60s. So his story is that four generations back, his great-great-great-great-great-great-grandfather, I guess, Crow Dog, shot and killed Spotted Eagle on the res, right after they were forced on the res. It was a political assassination, murder. It wasn't assassination because he knew it was coming. And they fought because he was giving in to the American government because he was going to let the American government take the land and do what they wanted to do with it. And they appointed him as chief, and they said, we don't have chiefs like that. Nobody appoints a chief among us. That's not who we are. They had a beef. He killed him. So he was sentenced to, so the Americans sentenced him to death. They took it to court in a landmark decision that threw it back to the reservation. Since they've changed the law, so they can't do that, but threw it back to the res. So they tried him in the Lakota way. And the Lakota said, okay, Crow Dog, this is what you have to do. For the life of this family, while you're alive, you have to support his family. You have to support his family, and then your family cannot live on the land here for four generations. Then your family can come back. Wow. Which Leonard Crow Dog did. He was the first one back on the res.
Wow.
After this generations of being banned.
Wow.
And so, but I'm thinking about the way they dealt with this dispute that landed in a murder and how they handled it, which was not like putting Crow Dog to death, but saying, you have to take care of this family. You have to make sure that for generations to come, his family's taken care of. That is what you're...
That's a beautiful story, and it's a story of restorative justice, and it's something that we've learned from Native Americans in Minnesota, California, and the West. My partner, Bernadine Dorn, was deeply involved in restorative justice efforts in Chicago.
When she was teaching law.
Yeah, and she was a law professor, but ran a clinic for children. But the point of restorative justice is exactly that. You caused harm. You have to repair the harm. It doesn't do any good to lock you into this institution of violence and keep you there. That just perpetuates harm. What we'd rather do is the harm you caused needs to be repaired. And I think that's a beautiful one. Small but beautiful example of what we call restorative justice.
So talk about what prison abolition would mean for you. I mean, what when you think about that, and how that, because you know people go, you can't just let all these crazy people out of jail, and some of them are just born killers. They're going to come back and terrorize community. What do you mean you want to abolish prison?
You know, when Stephen Colbert had his old show when he was a fake right wing commentator, and they were talking about. Letting people out of prison for nonviolent drug offenses, and he went crazy and he said, there'll be mass violence on the street. He said, imagine if I got 10 years for two joints, I'd get out and murder somebody. You know, so he was just sending it up. But the reality is that when I first got this idea, and it came to me through the hard work of people like Angela Davis and Erica Miners and Bernadine Dorn and others, the idea was completely wacky to me. How would you possibly get rid of prisons? And it's so much a part of the landscape. But the reality is that, and so it took me a while to come around to understand what the dimensions of it were. I was speaking at the University of Pittsburgh the first time I mentioned it out loud, and I said, I'm for abolishing all prisons. And of course, the first question was, just as you said, but what about the bad people? What about the crazies? What about murders on the streets? And I said, well, give me an example. And one guy seemed to have encyclopedic knowledge of John Wayne Gacy, and he gave me the whole...
Oh, you wrote about that in the book, right?
Yeah, and he gave me the whole story of the mass murder of John Wayne Gacy in Illinois, the first man executed after Illinois reinstated the death penalty. And I said, he exhausted me, and I said, okay, one prison cell. Who else? And then I said, okay, I'll give you Bush and Cheney. So now we have three. But the point was that if you start from the point of any misbehavior equals punishment, punishment equals prison, then we get up to 2.5 million. And you overlay that with white supremacy and racism and fear of others and so on, then you have 2.5 million prison cells. What we need to do is start somewhere else. And so with that group of kids in Pittsburgh, I said, well, look, let's imagine 1,000 alternatives to prison. Let's think of 1,000 alternatives. And then at the end of the day, maybe we will lock some people up, but not 2.5 million. And we began to brainstorm. And it was things like drug treatment, decent schools, jobs, childcare, mental health, et cetera, et cetera. And it's not that hard for smart people to sit for an hour and come up with many, many alternatives to prison, restorative justice being a major one, the one you began with. And then we begin to get it down to size and scale instead of thinking that the way to go is prison. But you can't do it without education, jobs, and a lot of other things, obviously. As long as we spend our money in prisons and criminal justice and policing and surveillance, we're not spending our money on education, healthcare, and guarantees of income.
Folks, do join us, 410-319-8888. What if? Give us your what ifs as we have this conversation. How would you think the society would now have to change? What would your dream be for what you'd like to see it be now with for your children, for your grandchildren, before you take your last breath? 410-319-8888. What is your what if? Or tweet us at Mark Steiner or send us an email to talk@steinershow.org. Let's see. So RA scientist, Koki, the scientist, tweeted in saying, Mark Steiner just said, I'm not tired yet. That's the voice of a freedom rider. You guys, nothing wrong with listening to elders. Okay, thank you for that, Koki.
And there's nothing wrong with listening to the youngers either. I think the young people are leading the way right now, as they always do, and I'm ecstatic to be around.
I happen to think that this generation of young people from the ages of 15 to 35 are perhaps one of the most amazing generations in our history of this country, in terms of the way their consciousness has risen, the way it's changed. I mean, it's building on the backs, the minds and the struggles of hundreds of years of people who came before them, but they really are the first generation where these mass numbers of young people are fighting racism. You've never seen 20-25% of white Americans fighting racism and even larger numbers among the millennials.
You said that so well. I mean, I'm always in awe of the young people. They're smarter, they're more informed, they're courageous, they're better looking than we were. I mean, they've got it all.
So let's talk about a couple of things here. We did a program last week about the Monsanto and Bayer, and that they may become one gigantic company, and what's happening. So you have a whole chapter here that I think that is really, really interesting, because it goes just beyond the food itself. But talk about what you wrote here around Monsanto and why you took that in that chapter.
Well, you know, I begin each chapter with a kind of an
index. I love that. Yeah, that's great.
It's a very brief attempt. I'm not a big statistical guy. I'm much more interested in the argument and the evidence. But I begin each chapter with an index. And so I begin the chapter, you know, on the environment, which is called Love the Earth, with an Earth Index. And I begin by saying Monsanto Company's annual budget lobbying the U.S. government is $4.3 million. The year the FDA approved Monsanto's bovine growth hormone banned in 31 countries for use in American cattle was 1993. And then I go on to talk about profits and all the rest of it. But the reason I begin with those kind of statistical, you know, glimpses into the world I'm talking about is because it gives you a sense of the great imbalance and the great kind of horror of our country turning into an autocracy, our country turning into a country that's really in the thrall of big capital, big agribusiness, big oil, big pharma, to the detriment of all of us. And we need to not only have a vision that we'd like to be better, but we need to know what the dimensions of the problem are. And that's why I began that way.
One of the things I think about with this was when I think about the things that you brought out in the book is that there are a lot of people who would be voting for Donald Trump who wouldn't necessarily disagree with parts of your book, especially about what you just articulated. But clearly the issue of racism and race in this country has divided people in America so deeply that people cannot see that their interests lie in the same place. You know, yeah. I think about it as we're reading this. There's so much in here whether it's the white folks who are in prison, the lowest rungs of the ladder in the white community. I mean, but the divide is so deep.
Yeah, and this is something that has been with us from the beginning. It's deep, deep into the American experience, the American DNA. But it's not something that's necessarily permanent. I mean, one of the things, you remember in an earlier book, you and I talked about this, that I'm a huge believer in talking to strangers. I'm a huge believer in engaging the right. Because I think if we, you know, one of the problems that we have as progressives, as a left, is that we get caught up in the idea that our ideas are either so special or so precious or so isolated that we have to barricade ourselves and congratulate ourselves. That's wrong. What we have to do is engage. So I remember you remind me that I was speaking at the University of Georgia, and as I began to talk, a group of Hell's Angels filed in wearing Tea Party Patriot patches, scared the crap out of me. And I gave my talk, and at the end of it, one of the Hell's Angels stood up and he said, "You know, I agree with you more than I thought I would, but I'm worried that you're a big government guy." And I said, "Well, I'm worried you're a big government guy." And he said, "Me? I'm not a big government guy." I said, "Good, let's close the Pentagon." And then he said, "No, not the Pentagon." And then we were having that conversation. But the point is that we mythologize one another. And I believe, and a lot of people think I'm nuts because I'm kind of an avatar of the far left, but I believe that on the 10 most important issues that we're facing as a country and as a people, I'm in the majority. I'm not in the minority.
What are those 10 most important issues for you?
Well, among them are, the degradation of the planet. Among them are mass incarceration. Among them are, a privatized, corporatized healthcare system. Among them are the collapse of public education and the public space. And I could go on. But I honestly believe that I'm in the majority. And the problem I often have is that I haven't found a way to articulate that in a way that I can, link arms with the people who I think it's in their interest and in fact, in their thinking already to see things in this way. You're right that race and white supremacy is a demon and a snake, and it's deep in our experience. But it's not permanent, and it's not something that can't be overcome. We have to work harder. We have to speak more clearly. We have to find the points of unity and then move them.
Do join us, folks. 410-319-8888. We're talking with Bill Ayers. Demand the Impossible, Radical Manifesto. He's speaking tonight, 7:30, is it? 7?
No, it's 6:30 at Plus Boys and Poets.
And which, at New York Avenue? No.
You know,
14th.
I'll find it. I think it's 14th. But then
14th
afterwards, we're going to watch the debate on the big screen and have a panel. So that'll be fun. I guess, or it'll be torture. I'm not sure.
I'm looking forward to watching it. I have to do something earlier than that, but I'm definitely looking forward to watching it. So you have a piece, your one chapter in here that you start with Laquan McDonald on police.
Right, and the chapter is called "Stop the Cops."
Stop the Cops, and we're watching this thing explode. We saw this stuff 50 years ago, but there's something about what's happening right now. There's something about the increased power of the NRA that you write about in here. The militarization of the police.
Yeah.
What's happening to our police?
Well, I think when we were talking earlier with SUNY, he pointed out that the Fruitvale Station case. He pointed out the riots of 50 years ago were all started around police violence, and that was true in Cleveland. It was true in Newark. It was true in Chicago. So this is not new. What's new, and you pointed to it a minute ago, is that young people are organized, forceful, intelligent, sophisticated, and fighting back. And that means that it's partly the videos. The videos count for a lot, but it's more than the videos. And the Laquan McDonald case is so interesting because it was a classic example of police violence, police occupation, the militarization of the police. And then for 2 years, or a year and a half, the cover-up, participated in by the media, by all the major newspapers and television stations, who just parroted the narrative that's already been written, and they just trot out different details. The narrative is there was a threat. He was threatening. He was coming at them, and so on. He was armed. And then it turns out the video comes out. None of that is true. But the video didn't take place in isolation. The video came out with a group of very sophisticated young people on the streets in Chicago for years, fighting against police violence and linking police violence to the degradation of the schools, the disappearance of the public space, and no jobs. And so the Black Lives Matter folks in Chicago are linking these issues in a way that's really creating a movement.
So what is the what if here?
The what if is, what if, let me take Chicago for just a quick example, because it's where we live and suffer and celebrate. Chicago, last year or 2 years ago, the mayor of Chicago closed 50 public schools in African-American neighborhoods, in poor neighborhoods. Last spring, the mayor of the city of Chicago, his school board, fired 1,000 teachers. Last week, the city of Chicago hired 1,000 police. Is there a link between those things? Can you see the numbers? So a quarter of our budget, a quarter to a third of Chicago's budget goes to the police. They don't stop violence. They create violence. They don't, you know, if you look at everything, including this recent case in Charlotte, which has driven me nuts, as I think it's driven most people of goodwill, there was no reason to confront this guy. What was the point of the confrontation? And this is true again and again, a traffic stop in one
case. Sandra Bland.
Yeah, Sandra Bland and a traffic stop and somebody who won't, Freddie Gray, who won't answer the command. But in this case in Charlotte last week, this man, they say, well, they thought he was rolling a blunt. So what? That's not a call for lethal force. That's right. Not a capital crime.
I thought he had a gun, and North Carolina is a right to carry state. So exactly. Why would you even talk to somebody who thought he had a carry
gun? Exactly, but he wasn't doing anything.
Right.
He was sitting in his car
if he had
waiting
a gun,
for his son.
Know.
And we don't know about the gun, but it's almost irrelevant. The confrontation was begun by the police. So the what if is, what if we didn't think of policing as the only answer for public safety? What if we thought about community policing? Or what if and I don't mean the organized police force. What if we thought about taking care of one another? In a city like Detroit, in which the public space has collapsed in many, many ways, the wonderful thing about Detroit is the activists have found all kinds of ways to rethink transportation, to rethink food, to rethink education, and to rethink public safety. If you call the police, things are going to escalate. They call each other. And it becomes a very different kind of culture.
You know, one of the things we talked about here, it's a digression from your book, but it's not really.
That's fine.
Which is that, given what's happened in Baltimore the last year, since Freddie Gray, some of us are pushing an idea here of thinking about public safety in a very different way. It's a what-if thing, but it's not crazy, right? Neither is what-if. So the city police department budget is $620 million. A huge portion of the city budget. Supposing you took a fifth of that budget, take any number, just play with any number you want, and instead you use that money to take people, to give the money to communities to take care of themselves. In other words, there's groups out here like Out for Justice, which are women who have done time in prison, and they're out for justice here back in the community. The Safe Streets, Communities United, which are a lot of people who live in the housing projects, put the money there. Let them, people, they are the first responders.
I love it.
You know, as opposed to the police being the first responders.
I love it.
There's a little boy who was shot in the leg here about 5 months ago by the police because he was carrying a BB gun and a basketball. So, and my argument to the city officials is, if it was a young woman from Out for Justice or one of the people from Communities United walking the streets or hanging around, they would have walked over to that little boy and said, son, what is that in your hand? What are you doing?
Exactly.
De-escalated everything, taking care of him. He would never have been shot.
Exactly. It's the occupying force of the police. It's the sense of an alien community that we must occupy and control. You're exactly right. That's a beautiful statement. Think about what we just saw from Charlotte. The wife of this man is saying, the tone of voice just breaks your heart.
It does.
She's saying, don't shoot him. Don't shoot him. He's not a threat to you. Don't shoot him. And pleading with them, if she had been allowed, if they just backed up and she'd been allowed to talk to her husband, the whole thing would have been resolved
exactly.
In about 2 minutes. So that's the example of Detroit. I love the example you gave of Baltimore. But this is also going back to Manolis Glesos in Greece. This is what he argued. He said, we're not going to spend money on policing as some kind of alien force coming in here. We're going to spend money on schools and guarantees of income and jobs. And there was no kind of special bureaucracy. When he was the mayor of this small island, they literally decided things in a committee of the whole.
Yeah, and what a
beautiful thing. So everybody comes to a meeting and they decide the big issues. And if they need somebody to be the commissioner of safety, they draw a name out of the hat. You know, and it becomes that kind of face-to-face democracy, real democracy, authentic participatory democracy, not some, phenomenon that's distant and far away.
So in a bunch of years since you been back.
Where did I go?
I don't know. I didn't. But where did you go? So in the years that you've been back, you've become a professor of education. And one of the things you write about in here is this, what to do with education and teaching and learning. And you use in the chapter a really important example, which were the freedom schools that were started by the SNCC workers in Mississippi and Alabama and other places.
They were the inspiration for me to get into teaching, really. The idea in the mid-60s, the Civil Rights Movement was in a lull. I mean, the story we tell about the Civil Rights Movement today is kind of one upward arc, but it wasn't like that. It was valleys and hills and mountaintops. And in 1963, at a low point in the Civil Rights Movement, a group of people got together and said that they wanted to start freedom schools as a way to regenerate energy into the Civil Rights Movement. And the freedom schools were powered by educational ideas that continued to not only inspire me, but to guide me. And the basic idea articulated by Charlie Cobb, who was a student nonviolent coordinating committee volunteer, was the idea that the people of Mississippi were denied many things, including forward-looking curriculum, fully trained teachers, decent facilities. But the fundamental injury is they were denied the right to think for themselves about the circumstances of their lives and how they got here. In other words, they were creating a school experience, and it wasn't inside a building. It was in a park or in a church or basement or anywhere that people could assemble. But the idea of the Freedom School was the people with the problems are the people with the solutions. There's always wisdom in the room. And the fundamental questions we have to ask are, who are we, how did we get here, and where do we want to go? That's the kind of education for free people that really ignites our imaginations, illuminates our lives, makes us strive toward freedom.
And one of the things you kind of show in here with stats as well, and I think it's really important, we've talked about a lot here on the program, which is when you look at what our public education school system should be like in America, look down the road at the private schools.
Or look to the rich suburbs.
That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
where the money is spent when you spend, I think when you have $37,000 a year or $57,000 a year spent per student at Sidwell Friends.
Exactly.
Right?
That's one example, but here's an even more telling, more recent example. Arnie Duncan was the head of the Chicago schools for 7 years. Then he was the head of the nation's schools for 7 years. He returns to Chicago, 14 years of being a school head, and he's been telling us how to build schools and the schools we ought to build. He returns to Chicago. He can't find a single school for his kids. So he sends his kids to the University of Chicago Lab School, private school, where they have classes capped at 15, where they have a curriculum based in part on the concerns and interests of the children, where they have a full arts program, including theater, painting, drama, orchestra, where they have a full sports program. That's what's good for Arnie Duncan's kids. That's what's good for the kids of the privileged. And if we don't start there as a kind of a baseline for what's good for all of our children, we will destroy democracy and will commit social suicide, which the example I was giving you of firing 1,000 teachers, hiring 1,000 police, that's social suicide. That's looking down the road to a point where we can't function any longer as a free people.
So I just want to say this about the book. A lot of really very cool people who I like a lot have written about this book, from Naomi Klein to Barbara Ransby, who's been on the show numerous times, Angela Davis, lots more. But it is a really interesting piece of work. Demand the Impossible, a Radical Manifesto. I think people who are involved in fighting and struggling to change our communities and change the way we do things, read this book, wrestle with what's in it, and think about how it fits us wherever you are. So, Bill, always good to see what you're going to come up with next.
Mark, I can't thank you enough. I'm always eager to listen to your show because what you come up with next always inspires me. Thanks so much.
Thank you. And you can see Bill tonight. He'll be speaking at Busboys and Poets at 14th and V in D.C. In the Langstrom Room at 6:30. But then stay around because they're going to be watching the debates together at 9 and then having a panel and talk about what they saw in the debates and ongoing things. That's always fun. I've done that before at Busboys and Poets, and it's always a blast. So you should take part in that.
Thank you, Mark.
Good to have you here. And thank you all for calling in, writing in, tuning in, being part of the discussion today. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our senior producer is Mark Gunnery. Our producer is Imani Spence. Our engineer is Andrew Melton. Our intern is Calvin Perry. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. Send me your thoughts about today's program to talk@steinershow.org, the podcast of Mark Steiner Show, and share it with your friends. Visit us on the web at steinershow.org or listen to us via your favorite podcasting app. And for your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.